time once again for Community Forum, and we are very lucky to have with us live in the studios this morning Professor Kevin Bales. He is the executive director of the Washington, D.C. based organization Free the Slaves. And among his many other titles that he holds, he is a consultant on the Global Program on Trafficking in Human Beings at the Center for International Crime Prevention at the United Nations. He is also author of the book Disposable People: New Slavery in the Global Economy. Kevin, thank you for coming in this morning.
Hey, it's great to be here.
Let me start out and ask you, how did you get involved in this issue?
You know, I actually picked up a leaflet at a public event. Now, this was in London where I was working at the time, but was at a kind of public outdoor event, and there was a little table from Anti-Slavery International with, in fact, an elderly supporter sitting at the table handing out leaflets, and I picked one up, read it on the bus going home, and I was shocked to discover the extent of contemporary forms of slavery. I thought I was an educated person who was aware of human rights. I'd worked in the area of human rights a bit. So I was very surprised. A lot of people say, oh, I can't believe I didn't know about this when I tell them about it. And I have to say, well, you know, I was there just a few years ago. I was equally shocked and surprised and felt like I should have known better. But that really piqued my interest and began to get me kind of churning, trying to figure out what, in fact, was going on out there in the world of contemporary slavery. And that pushed me to do the research that I did.
All right, and tell us a bit more about the organization Free the Slaves.
Well, Free the Slaves is the American sister organization of Anti-Slavery International. Anti-Slavery International is the world's first and oldest human rights organization. The founding meetings were in 1787, so it was the very first anti-slavery organization, and in that way, the very first human rights organization that humans have ever had. It's been operating continuously since that time. Sometimes large, sometimes small, depending on how the public sees the amount of slavery. And I serve on the board of trustees, the board of directors of Anti-Slavery International. And then about 4 years ago, moved back to the United States in order to, with other supporters, set up the American Anti-Slavery Organization, which we didn't call Anti-Slavery International. We called Free the Slaves because we thought it was a little more direct and thought, you know, it would help her, move to the American ear a little more easily. But we pursue the same kinds of ends, which are to come to understand slavery better in the world around us, to raise people's awareness about contemporary forms of slavery and how it touches their lives. We work hard to advocate and change laws in our own country and around the world. And we work very hard to support those grassroots organizations who are actually kicking down doors and setting people free and try to find the, you know, money, particularly from the vast resources of an American economy, which is so huge, that can be transferred to the global South to help those who have come out of slavery to achieve a stability in their life. And then we also, finally, spend a lot of time working on what we call slave-free trade. In other words, trying to find ways to take the slavery out of some of the products that I'm afraid almost everyone who's listening has in their own home.
All right. Give us a more of a picture of what we're talking about with the concept of modern-day slavery. Is it similar to what this country had back in the 1700s?
Well, the answer to that is yes and no. I mean, slavery, in fact, is slavery. It's in the and forgive the tautology, but what I mean is that slavery is when a person is completely controlled by someone else using violence. They're not paid anything. They can't walk away, and they're being economically exploited. Now, that, in fact, that little definition I just gave applies to slavery throughout all human history. I mean, it would apply in ancient Egypt, and it would apply in Alabama in 1850, and it would apply today. The differences, though, around that core set of attributes that describe slavery are, of course, what makes some kinds of slavery very different today to slavery in the past. So, obviously, slavery is not legal anymore. It was in the American past. Now it's illegal. But the experience of the slave is not extraordinarily different to that in the past because they still suffer under violent control. They're still economically exploited. So slavery has changed, but changed in a way that many things have changed in response to globalization, to economic change, to cultural change, to social change, political change. But it remains slavery in the sense that people are controlled and exploited really to serve other people's greed.
And then how many people are we talking about that are involved in slavery?
We spent a number of years trying to determine, answer that question. Our best estimate is that there are about 27 million people in the world in slavery today. And again, that's using a narrow definition. So not talking about sweatshops, not talking about being a slave to fashion or, you know, having a bad marriage. It's about not being able to walk away under complete violent control of another person, being economically exploited, being paid nothing. We think about 27 million people in the world in that situation.
And where is this primarily taking place? Is it worldwide or is it in a specific region?
Well, it's worldwide. I mean, there are slaves in virtually every country of the world, but it's more concentrated in some of the more populous countries of the global south. So a country like India, that has, after all, a billion people, you know, there are a billion people in the country of India, that also has a long tradition of a kind of slavery called debt bondage. We know there are millions of people in India, Pakistan, Nepal, in South Asia who are caught up in that kind of slavery. Also that there's an awful lot of slavery in North and West Africa, sometimes sponsored by the state, as in Sudan, sometimes as part of more traditional uses of children, as in West Africa, or in countries like Burma. I think a lot of your listeners will know about the horrific military regime in Burma that has enslaved its own citizens to use as pack horses, basically, in their military campaigns against some of their other citizens. So there's slavery more concentrated in other countries than others, but spread across the planet. You know, I've never heard of a slave in Iceland, but that may be the only place, you know, that I haven't. In the United States, a fair number in slavery, probably somewhere between 60 and 100,000 people in slavery in the United States at any one time.
And would there be a correlation? You mentioned globalization earlier as being one of the causes of this jump in slavery.
Well, globalization is part of the factors that create a situation where there can be a very large increase in the amount of slavery. I wouldn't necessarily say it was a cause as much as a factor that helps contribute to it. In fact, the population explosion that occurred after the Second World War was primarily an explosion in the population of the Global South. That doesn't make people slaves, but it added 4 billion people to the world population. Those people, sadly, were born into a world in which they were more likely to be impoverished, more likely to be vulnerable, more likely to be discriminated against than in many ways in the past. The changes, and this is where globalization comes in, the changes of the economies of their countries as they're pushed out of the countryside, as they're pushed away from subsistence agriculture and into cash crop economies that serve the global market. All of that helped to press that large number of new people from the population explosion into situations of extreme vulnerability. And you can go to the developing world and you can see, particularly in the shanty towns that surround the major cities, millions of people who lack social, economic, political power, who are very vulnerable. But that doesn't make them slaves either. In fact, to turn those vulnerable people into slaves, you have to have the third leg of the stool, and that's corruption, governmental and especially police corruption. Because once the police are corrupt, and the police will agree to sell or rent their violence, or to turn a blind eye for a price, it means that if you can use violence with impunity, you can turn highly vulnerable people into slaves. And that's the situation around the world. The population explosion and the economic change has produced a glut, a great reservoir of potentially enslavable people who don't necessarily have the power to resist violent control. And the corruption, which is also a product in some ways of that global economic change, creates the mechanism for turning that surplus, that reservoir of potential slaves, for some of them, into slaves.
So do you see a correlation between, let's say, the efforts of countries that the World Bank focuses on and the economic situation that they set up and slavery in those countries?
Well, I mean, interesting that you use the word correlation, because, and this where I probably have to warn everybody, it could turn intensely boring in a couple of seconds, because I was also trained as a statistician, and not long ago I created a data set of all the countries in the world and actually analyzed statistically the relationship between international debt loading and the amount of human slavery and human trafficking from countries in the developing world. And in fact, correlation is exactly what there was in the statistical sense as well as the kind of conceptual sense. The greater the amount of debt loading, and that debt loading is, of course, a product of World Bank and IMF policy, the greater the amount of that debt, of international debt, the greater amount of slavery in a country.
Now, you mentioned that corruption is one of the key contributing factors to this. My understanding is slavery is illegal worldwide. Is that correct?
Oh, yes, that's right.
So these people who are supposed to be actually protecting one against slavery are in fact, being the contributors towards it.
Oh, it's true, and it's sad. I mean, in the U.S., usually, the police would protect you from the denizens of organized crime. But, you know, say in a country like Thailand, where I've done work, the police are organized crime. You know, they're part of the organized crime networks, and the primary income generator for police in that country is bribes from illegal operations, businesses of all sorts, but including businesses that are using enslaved workers, very often, especially teenage prostitutes who have been enslaved into brothels. That's how they make their money, and they make a lot of money out of that. And that's one of the toughest problems we face, is rooting out that kind of corruption and getting countries, helping countries somehow to the point that they can enforce the laws that they've already got on the books. And of course, it's not monolithic. In every country that we've worked, we find government officials who are honest, government officials who are keen to do the right thing, that want to fight slavery, and then at the grassroots level, corrupt officials, corrupt police, local elected mayors and so forth, who do everything they can to protect slaveholders.
Talk about what structures there are to help countries enforce the laws. Would the United Nations, who I know you work with, would they be one of the organizations that would be doing that?
Oh, indeed. And in fact, one of my jobs in the recent past was to help put together a plan for all the countries of the ECOWAS countries, which are the economic community of West African states. So the 14 countries of the West African coast belong to a governmental organization, which is a lot like the European Union is for all of Europe, where they agree. They actually, a number of them share the same currency and like that. But in fact, what we did was prepare for them a legislative guide so that they would all be passing the same laws. They would all be bringing in the same programs of border control, travel documents, of investigations, of record keeping and research, and bringing in the same policies of rehabilitation and support. The idea being that since human trafficking particularly is a transnational problem, it has to be dealt with a transnational solution. And the UN was very much helping to guide those countries. And the same thing happens with the Organization for Cooperation and Security in Europe. They provide help to particularly Eastern European countries or Central Asian countries in preparing their legal systems, training their police, rooting out corruption, and so forth. So, yes, the UN, the other big international governmental organizations do that, and we do that. We when asked, and sometimes when we're not asked, offer up advice and suggestions about how governments and countries could perhaps do a better job about dealing with the slavery inside their borders. Now, sometimes they listen and sometimes they don't. Sometimes they listen politely and they have no intention of doing anything about it. I was recently in Burma and spoke to members of the ruling dictatorship. And I tell you, you know, it's a funny thing to have a job where you go around and meet military dictators, but it was one of those situations where you think, well, I have to at least try to talk to them in a civil way at least once to see if any progress can be made. And, you know, we had a very civil conversation, but I don't know if any progress is going to be made. And I think that's probably the end of our civil conversation. We'll go back to kicking them when we can.
I understand you also spent some time yesterday down at our state capitol talking with our own legislators. Is that a typical thing that you do?
Oh, yes, very often. And, of course, for me, it was equally a learning experience because, you know, Washington State, you know, I don't know if people in Washington necessarily know that their state is leading the country on issues of human trafficking. That Washington State's legislation setting up a task force on human trafficking at the state governmental level, the new criminalizing laws on human trafficking, the way that the non-governmental organizations, the social service agencies, the law enforcement groups, the state legislators have all worked together and formed a really strong operating coalition means that people in the other parts of the country are looking to Washington State saying, okay, how do we do this? How do we arrive at a situation where trafficked people, people who are victims of human trafficking, can get the best protection? How can we best prevent it? How can we get the most prosecutions? And, you know, for the wonderful work that it's doing, the legislature here, and particularly Velma Valoria, has done a fantastic job in leading that effort and leading that legislative effort. It also means, of course, that you're making all the mistakes first. I mean, the state is making the mistakes first. And so other people are learning both from your successes and your failures in Washington State. But, Washington State leads the way. And that's very inspiring to the rest of us.
Yeah, that's good news. Now, contrary to that, I'm kind of curious what your dealings with and your perspective on organizations, let's say, like the WTO and GATT would be, because they went out of their way to exclude concepts like human rights in their economic structure. Has that been a major hurdle for this movement?
Well, not a major hurdle, I should say, yet. We have done as well as we could. We're trying hard to infiltrate, if you will, into anyone who has potential influence on this issue. And again, you know, sometimes it makes for strange bedfellows. And, you know, what's the saying about, you know, if you eat with the devil, you sup with a long spoon. And sometimes we have to take very long spoons into our meetings, but, you know, the WTO has yet to give us a chance to talk directly to them. We have to do that through other means, other channels. But it could be. You know, obviously, the decision in the formation documents for the World Trade Organization that excluded notions of either environmental or social justice accountability was a damning failure in the establishment of that organization and creates a context where profits are put before people. And we've seen this, you know, we all understand that. And it's getting slightly better. Because extra rules, laws, international treaties are being brought to bear specifically about human trafficking and slavery. But it was only until about 2000 or 2001 that, you know, you could be prosecuted for piracy of a Michael Jackson CD in China. China could be published, you know, for stealing a Britney Spears CD and counterfeiting it. But the transfer of human beings by China wouldn't necessarily be prosecuted. Now, that at least is altered, and there is a new United Nations Convention on Human Trafficking, which is being promulgated. But it should, in fact, exactly as you're suggesting, Mike, be included in the framing documents of those international economic organizations.
Sticking with the economics of this, because that seems to be a primary contributor to the whole concept of modern slavery. Could you talk about the numbers that the money that people are paying for slaves and how that contributes to exacerbating the problem further? I understand slaves today are far cheaper comparatively to, let's say, they were in the U.S. back in the 1700s, 1800s.
Exactly. And in fact, that's the big news in terms of what slavery is about. The big news is that in the last 40 to 50 years, in part because of that great surplus reservoir of potentially enslavable people that we were talking about earlier, has led us to a situation where slaves today are cheaper than they've ever been in human history. And to illustrate that, let me just point out that, you know, in 2004 dollars, the cost of a slave in 1850 in the Deep South was about $38,000. I mean, it was $1,000 in 1850 money, but that's $38,000 in today's money. Slaves in the past were major capital purchase items. And for that reason, they were, you know, the owner of this major capital purchase item wanted a number of things, like a legal deed of ownership, an insurance. You know, and slaves were often insured against loss or illness. And they, of course, would call the police if they were lost or stolen or whatever. Today, and this is the horrific new truth, is that that vast surplus reservoir of potentially enslavable people has put a glut on the market. And the price of slaves has fallen to an all-time historical low. In one piece of work that we did in West Africa, we were able to go into we sent a local journalist with a hidden camera into a local market in central Ivory Coast and purchased two 19-year-old male agricultural workers for $40 each. $40 for a human being. And of course, you're still buying what someone paid $38,000 for, or the equivalent, in the Deep South 150 years ago. You're buying the complete, total productive capacity of a human being that you own 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, as long as you want them. But now, the as long as you want them, sort of the key to the situation here. You know, if you're paying $40 for anything, you know, you won't attach quite as much concern to that purchase as you would if it cost $38,000. And the reality, the horrific reality of modern slavery is that human beings are so cheap that they're treated as disposable, throwaway items in people's economic activity. So the slave of the past who had a horrible life but might have been cared for because they represented an investment, today will simply be used up, often destroyed, and then tossed, dumped, because they're so very cheap.
You mentioned at the top of the show some of how we all probably have products in our homes that are made by slave labor. Could you go into that some more and talk about perhaps what you see as some of the solutions to this problem?
Sure. The fact is that there are a number of commodities and products that flow into our homes that have a kind of taint of slavery. It's not that, you know, let me name some of them. Cocoa or chocolate, coffee, sugar, cotton, steel, particularly South American steel, all have slave input. But we're in a very different situation than we might have been in the distant past where, you know, they knew that all the cotton that came out of the United States, which was the major cotton supplier to the world, was slave cotton. Today, we're in a situation where it's only a small percentage of cotton or coffee or cocoa or steel that actually has come from the hands of slaves. The difficulty for us as consumers is that that commodity that's been made by slaves gets mixed up in the world, in the global commodities market, with cotton or coffee or cocoa or whatever that wasn't made by slaves. And we can't tell at the moment, for the most part, when we're actually touching the product of slaves and when we're not. Now, that's maddening. You know, that's maddening because none of us want to eat slave-made chocolate. None of us want to wear slave-made cotton. But the reality is that, in fact, you know, that beautiful red shirt, your slightly wrinkled shirt that you're wearing, might have, you know, 3% of the cotton in that shirt comes from the hand of slaves, or less, and the rest doesn't. And it's a real challenge about how we find a way to bring it into the exploitation of slaves to make the cotton for your shirt without harming the other 98% of the farmers who aren't using slave labor, who are growing cotton, who in the developing world, in the global South especially, are already having to compete with American farmers who are receiving billions in American agricultural subsidies. There's no fair trade for, of course, farmers in the global South. That's all bogus. And the Americans have created a playing field that only slopes one direction. The farmers in the global South have to compete against the billion-dollar subsidies to American farmers. And it means that some turn toward slave labor as a way of reducing their costs and increasing their profits. But if we begin to boycott, and this is where I wanted to touch on, is that if we begin to boycott the purchases that might have a tiny fraction of slave labor in them, it hurts more the people who are doing their farming or their commodity production without slaves. They're the ones who are actually making lower profits. They're the ones who, because they're not using slave labor, they're the ones who are closer to the edge of economic collapse, for whom a boycott could lead to a terrible situation and potentially enslavement themselves. If they, you know, if they're wiped out because their products can't sell, there's a chance that they can fall into a situation where their vulnerability is so increased that they become enslaved themselves. We've come to the conclusion that you have to intervene at the point where the slavery occurs, that it's no use, you know, refusing to buy that $30 shirt unless you've decided that you're going to take the $30 you were going to spend on the shirt and, in fact, give it to an anti-slavery organization to spend at the point at which slavery is occurring in the cotton field 17 or 27 steps back down the product chain at the point where slavery actually exists in cotton production. Now, there are a number of ways to do that, some by supporting organizations like Free the Slaves, who work directly with grassroots organizations. And I have to say, you know, we've had a bit of a breakthrough with the chocolate industry, where the major chocolate companies have now signed on to an agreement with us and others to bankroll that work at the grassroots level. And this is fantastic. Now, but it's only chocolate. It's only cocoa that we have that agreement. And we need to reach out now and build similar agreements with people and companies who use other commodities that we know have input from slaves, like cotton, coffee, sugar, steel, and so forth.
Do you foresee a labeling campaign similar to the Fair Trade labeling campaign that they do with coffee now that seems to actually be growing?
Well, I have to say, fair trade is very important as a way to approach the situation of enslavement, in particularly in commodity production, because if farmers can rely on a fair trade price for their produce, they're never going to end up using slave labor, and they're almost never going to come into a situation of vulnerability that could make them enslavable. However, the labeling, because of what I was saying about the fact that the slave input is a tiny percentage of the total input, say to a chocolate bar, labeling doesn't really quite make sense. Most of the cocoa is slave-free already. Now, of course, you know, the chocolate companies or the cotton company, whoever, they're already worried about having a label. It's one of those, it's like putting a sign around your neck that says, you know, I have now stopped beating my wife. You know, if you put a sign on your chocolate bar that says, you know, now all our chocolate bars are slave-free. But in fact, you know, most of their chocolate is slave-free. So it's not really a labeling scheme, I think, that's going to go. However, the label that says fair trade is always the label that I buy, because I know that way I'm guaranteed that I'm not even accidentally getting involved in a slave-made product.
How can people find out more about your organization?
Well, the easiest is, of course, to go to the website. And the website's freetheslaves, all one word, freetheslaves.net. So freetheslaves.net. And on there we have all kinds of stuff for all kinds of people, teacher packs for teachers, and information about economics for people who are interested in that, and information about grassroots organizations that we support and work with. So it's worth a visit.
Very good. All right. We are unfortunately out of time, so I want to thank you for coming in today.
It was great. Thank you, Mike.
We've just been talking with Professor Kevin Bales. He is the executive director of the Washington, D.C.-based group Free the Slaves. He is also author of Disposable People, New Slavery in the Global Economy.